Whitney Media 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and it can be heard live streaming worldwide on WVOX.com. One can call into WVOX at 914-636-0110. But as I say each week, please stay germane to our subject. My guest today is Hazel Rowley, a historian and author of Franklin and Eleanor, An Extraordinary Marriage. Welcome, Hazel, to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me today in the studio.
Thank you, Richard.
You know, meanwhile, as I say each week, the mission of The Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. My guest, Ms. Hazel Rowley, was brought up in England and in Australia, lives in New York City. Her new book, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, An Extraordinary Marriage, is currently available in bookstores. It was published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. While living in Paris, she wrote the Washington Post best book for 2005, Tête-à-Tête, The Tumultuous Lives and Loves of Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre. Right?
Very good.
And she's also the author of Richard Reif, The Life and Times, while she was affiliated with the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute for Afro-American Studies at Harvard. And Christina Steed, a biography, a winner of the 1993 Australian National Book Award for Nonfiction. She's published articles in the Partisan Review, in Mississippi Quarterly, Antioch Review, many other areas. And she's currently on a nationwide book tour for Franklin and Eleanor. And she was just in Washington speaking at the National Portrait Gallery. Is that correct?
Yes.
It's a wonderful place. Mm. You know, over the years, I've had the distinct opportunity of devoting 20 shows to the lifetimes and works of Franklin Roosevelt, which have included authors, commentators, biographers, lecturers, individuals as Jonathan Alter, the Honorable William Vandenhoevel, Cynthia Cook, the director of the Roosevelt Library, Professors Noah Feldman and Jeffrey Rosen. They have discussed the Roosevelt Court, of course, and I have featured a show about Val Kill, the home of Eleanor Roosevelt. Today, I have the pleasure of hosting Hazel Rowley, who has successfully taken on the decades-old challenge of capturing the essence of the millennium's most famous couple's life together. The Roosevelts and their times have been chronicled over 1,000 times by numerous historians and biographers, but few have been able to focus so successfully on their unique partnership. With that in mind, Hazel, why were you inspired to write another book on the Roosevelts?
Well, you know, the marriage as such hasn't been done for 40 years. This book began when I went up to the FDR Museum a few years ago, that wonderful museum in Hyde Park in the Hudson Valley, and I was struck that everybody was asking the tour guide questions about the Roosevelt marriage, about the couple. And someone asked if there was a good book on the subject, and the guide said, well, Joseph Lash's Eleanor and Franklin, but she said that was published, you know, 40 years ago.
Right.
And then the Doris Kearns Goodwin's No Ordinary Time book, excellent, but that just focuses on the war years, the last 5 years in a 40-year marriage. So by the time I drove back to Manhattan at the end of that day, I had my new book in my head.
Well, and so you obviously knew what you wanted. You didn't worry about that had been done, and you figured that you needed an update, I gather, in that sense of, because I think all marriages have been under question in recent days. I mean, all the secrets, many of the secrets come out. You know, there have been many theories posed about their marriage, their personal relationships, and the fact that many look at it as a political relationship. Your view of the marriage is far more positive than most. Can you tell us more?
I'm actually struck by how negatively people, even today, do see this marriage. Everybody knows about FDR's romance with Lucy Mercer. Most people know that Eleanor had a lesbian romance with Lorena Hickok. Everybody knows that the Roosevelts spent quite a lot of time apart. So their conclusion is clear, isn't it? It was a lousy marriage. It was just a public facade. I see it completely differently. It's my view that the marriage made these two great individuals possible. At Hyde Park that day, I found myself wondering, how was it possible for this man from this sheltered aristocratic world at Hyde Park, who was struck by polio at the age of 39 and became a paraplegic and couldn't take a single step on his own for the rest of his life, how could he become president of the United States? And how was it possible for Eleanor, who began life as feeling that she was an ugly duckling, very shy, insecure, and orphan from the most prominent Republican family in the U.S. at that time, Theodore Roosevelt's family, how could she become the most progressive, outspoken, independent, courageous, and controversial first lady this country has ever known? And it was clear to me that day, even before I began that my research, that it had a great deal to do with the marriage.
Right. You know, it's interesting as you said that, and it's a very important point that should not be overlooked or not emphasized. Samuel Eliot Morrison, the great American historian, said that if Franklin Roosevelt had served one day in office and had died, he would have been remarkable for winning as a man who could not walk. And it's really amazing. You know, people talk about the fact he wasn't photographed and he this and that and posed as a man at the head of the ship of state and, you know, all the kind of things he did, which were unique to him and his ability to communicate. But that still is remarkable.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, what do you see as the turning points in this marriage, the moments when it evolved into something different?
Well, we should say that it began as a quite conventional marriage between two American aristocrats. Eleanor Roosevelt didn't even have to change her name. They were fifth cousins once removed. Eleanor Roosevelt was marrying Franklin Roosevelt. So they made the headlines that day because the person who gave the bride away, since her father was dead, just happened to be the young, vigorous, very popular president of the U.S. at the time, Theodore Roosevelt. And they lived for the first few years very much under the thumb of Franklin's mother, Sarah. Eleanor had four kids in 5.5 years, which she didn't much like. Franklin was a lawyer, which he didn't much like. And in between the connecting doors in their mutual twin house shared by Franklin's mother and them, Sarah Roosevelt kept looming through the connecting doors. So the early years of the marriage were difficult and conventional. This was the repressive Victorian era. 5 years into the marriage was the first bold step against tradition. Theodore Roosevelt was no longer in office. Franklin stood as state senator, as a candidate for the state senate in, of all places, the Hudson Valley area where he grew up, which was a solid Republican farming area, and he stood as a Democrat. And to everybody's incredulity, he won the seat. Mm. They moved to Albany, and those 3 years in Albany were very important years. I think the marriage was much happier, partly because they were no longer living in the same house as Sarah Roosevelt, but also those 3 years, three things happened that were important. Franklin got on the national map as a sort of bold politician prepared to take on the corruption of Tammany Hall, you know, the Democratic machine in New York City. A wizened, intense, hard-smoking man came to the house to interview Franklin and went home telling his wife that he'd just met the future president of the United States. He was convinced. And Eleanor took an interest in politics. That was when her interest in politics began. And so Albany was a good time. But I should just emphasize one thing. You know, that was an extraordinary step for aristocrats to take. As we know, aristocrats are traditionally Republicans. And the Roosevelt family was a great Republican family. And here they were. You know, Franklin was considered a traitor to his class. Eleanor stood proudly beside him. And that was, I think, their first step.
Very interesting. We're going to go more into more detail after the break. We're coming up against a short financial news update. I want to remind our audience that they're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM and live streaming worldwide on WVOX.com. And my guest is Hazel Rowley, historian and author. When we come back, we'll focus a bit on a story about Lucy Mercer, who she was, and a chapter called Tragedy at Campobello. Thanks. Bye-bye. We'll be back.
with business news at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour. Here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide and WVIP HD2.
From the Fox Business Network, plenty of deals announced today as China's President Hu Jintao kicks off his four-day tour of the United States. China and the U.S. reaching several export deals worth $45 billion. The biggest deal, an order of 200 airplanes from Boeing, is valued at $19 billion. And the Republican-controlled House is expected to repeal President Obama's health care reform law today, but there are no plans to take the measure up in the Senate, where the repeal effort could die. And the FDIC chairwoman, Sheila Bair, wants the mortgage servicing industry to fund a new commission to pay homeowners who lost their houses because of errors made by the servicers. Bair says the commission could be modeled after those created for the victims of 9/11 and the BP oil spill. Bair also making headlines today when she rejected Wells Fargo's controversial proposal to require a 30% down payment to purchase a house. Bair says the traditional 20% down payment should remain the industry standard. With the Fox Business Report, I'm Adam Shapiro.
The New York Times reported that over 130 million credit and debit cards were recently stolen. I'm Police Chief Joe DeLaterrante. Why risk identity theft when just $10 a month helps protect you? I signed up for LifeLock, and you should too.
Enroll now and mention Radio 60 to try LifeLock risk-free for 60 days. Cancel LifeLock within 60 days to receive a full refund. 1-800-440-4894. 800-440-4894. Chief Joe DeLaterrante is a compensated endorser.
Amplify your voice.
Easy to work. Press talk button.
AM 1460, WVOX, and WVIP HD2, New Rochelle.
1460, WVOX.
Now, back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates with my guest, author and biographer, Hazel Rowley, who's written a fascinating biography of the unique and extraordinary marriage of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. We're going to talk a little bit about in this next segment about the tragedy at Campbell. But before that tragedy happened, and what was it about? Who was Lucy Mercer, and how did she come into their lives?
Well, Franklin, this was the in 1913, when Franklin was 31, he landed the prestigious post of Assistant Secretary of the Navy in Washington, and Eleanor went to extraordinary lengths to help him in his job. And when she found herself pregnant yet again, she employed a social secretary called Lucy Mercer, an attractive, smiley young woman, to help out. And she became part of the Roosevelt household. These were the First World War years. Franklin's post in the Navy was incredibly important. He was building up the U.S. Navy, a rather heady job, and he was in his prime, no polio. Everybody commented on his media star good looks. We skip a bit. We skip to the summer of 1918 when Franklin went to Europe to inspect American naval operations on the front line. Eleanor stayed behind in Washington working for the Red Cross, war work. And when Franklin came back in September, he had double pneumonia, had to be carried off the ship on a stretcher. And Eleanor at home unpacked his suitcase and came across a stack of love letters from Lucy Mercer. Not a good moment in the marriage. She certainly suspected something, but not this. Biographers, I should say, make a great deal of Lucy Mercer in Franklin's life. Many say the marriage never recovered from it. I don't see it this way at all. We don't know much about this romance. We don't even know whether it was consummated. But for some reason, much has been made of Lucy as the love of his life. It's perhaps because she was coincidentally with him when he died at Warm Springs, among the various other women and men down there with him. But Eleanor did get over this tragic moment. In fact, I think it made her realize that she had to find an identity beyond being a wife. And by then, 1920, the World War One was over, values were changing, and Eleanor was changing. She got over it.
Mm-hmm. You know, of course, I agree with you. I think this has been a tendency to talk more about it than what the substance was. He was a lonely man. on one hand, his wife was building another chapter of her life, traveling, all of issues. He wore out people around him. The pace of the New Deal was incredible. And in fact, if you look back on the history of the New Deal, especially the first 8 years, Franklin Roosevelt had very little time for anything.
Yes.
No less Lucy Mercer, who he basically had her invited to his inaugurations. And in the sense that he was pining over her is really a fabrication, and more or less. You know, what about in moving along very quickly, what about this tragedy at Campobello? It's deeply poignant. You shift gears and move to a narrative in slow motion, whereas your story generally moves fast at quite a clip. Most of this chapter is set in the summer of 1921. What happened there?
A catastrophe of unimaginable proportions. Franklin and Eleanor themselves would always play down Franklin's polio. They had to. But I wanted to show it all in its stark horror. So that chapter, the summer of 1921, when they're on the remote island of Campobello, a Canadian island off the north coast of Maine, Franklin, who was all set up, you know, he was on the road to become governor of New York, president, and so on, he came down with what they at first thought was flu. He went to bed shivering. 2 days later, he was paralyzed. At first, actually, the paralysis went right up to his face. Later, it came down to his, you know, below the hips. But I tell the story, as you say, in slow motion, because I think it was such an important moment in their lives. There were no helicopters to land on Campobello to airlift him to a hospital. There was no bridge on which an ambulance could cross. The one telephone on the island at the general store, if Eleanor had described his condition, there would have been panic on the island. So the doctor had to come across the straits from Lübeck and tell Eleanor how to insert a catheter, how to administer an enema. And it took 2 weeks for a Boston specialist in polio to arrive on the island, during which time Franklin couldn't move, he couldn't turn. Eleanor devotedly nursed him around the clock. And I talk about, when they go back to New York, the absolute torment, the upheaval in the Roosevelt family, and how Eleanor dealt with it. Franklin's nurse thought that she was pushing him too much. Certainly Sarah Roosevelt, Franklin's mother, thought that. But later on, Franklin's doctors would say that Franklin owed a great deal of his mental and physical rehabilitation to Eleanor. Mm.
You know, no question, as you show, Franklin's polio was a turning point in their marriage, as many biographers see it. They think that they were drifting away at this point, but most evidence is not that. And of course, one of the turning points in the character of Franklin Roosevelt was when people asked him about his patience, how he dealt with things. And he said, if it takes you 2 years to wiggle your big toe, you learn patience in this sense. And he was a very determined man. He was determined as a youth. He was determined in a recovery. And he became determined as president. She was a real hero at Campobello. And of course, Sunrise at Campobello does not do justice to the gravity of his situation. And her relationship with his confidant, political advisor, and maybe only friend, as it turned out, Louis Howe, seems to change and affect her. What happened, especially with Louis Howe, and what did he do for her?
Louis Howe, well, he was there on Campobello at the time and helped Eleanor in every way, and he was responsible for that evacuation from the island when Franklin was able to, not to move, he couldn't move, but they got him off the island on a train back to New York, and Louis Howe was tremendously clever at sort of rigging this up so that reporters wouldn't find out the truth. He moved into the Roosevelt House in New York and took over Franklin's work in Franklin's name. And his own family lived in Poughkeepsie near Hyde Park, and he went to see them at weekends. Louis Howe was somewhat of a hero, really, in my story. He was devoted to Franklin and to Eleanor, and they to him. He was a wonderful man.
No question. And there have been a number of treatments on him. And I had Julie Fenster on, who wrote a great biography and a connection between Roosevelt and Howe. We have to break for a commercial. And I want to remind our audience that they're listening to WVOX 1460 AM. We're live streaming worldwide. WVOX with my guest, Ms. Hazel Rowley. We're talking about her book, Franklin and Eleanor, An Extraordinary Marriage. When we come back from our break, I'm going to ask Hazel the following question. Tell us a bit about FDR's long period of recovery and the role of Missy Lehan, Margaret Missy Lehan, in his recovery. We'll be back in a moment. Thank you.
And national news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu. Debate underway now in the House as Republicans gear up for a vote on repealing health care reform. Representative Mike Kelly of Pennsylvania calling the president's plan too expensive.
Choices for small business under Obamacare are provide government-mandated health care and face ruinous cost, or drop the coverage and pay fines just to keep those folks employed.
New Mexico Democrat Martin Heinrich calling repeal a mistake.
I urge my colleagues to vote against a return to the broken health care system that we spent decades trying to fix.
The measure is expected to pass the House, but not the Senate, where one of its lawmakers has just made a major announcement. Four-term Senator Joe Lieberman saying he will retire next year, not seek re-election. And a Philadelphia abortion provider has been charged in the murder of a woman and seven babies who prosecutors say were born alive, then killed. Fox News. We report, you decide.
There are quite a number of neighborhood flower shops around Westchester County these days. As in all things, some are better than others. And in the Colonial Village Shopping Center on Weaver Street in Scarsdale, just to the north of New Rochelle, there exists a florist of very great style and renown. Colonial Village Flowers specializes in beautiful seasonal flowers arranged in good taste with the lovely low-key result that all Colonial Village presentations, bouquets, and arrangements look like they were actually grown, collected, and gathered in the natural setting of your own garden. Good taste in flowers has for years been a special trademark of Joe Ward and his talented floral arrangers at Colonial Village, featuring the natural look without pomp or ceremony. So please, know that there is at least one flower shop on your classy wavelength. Joe Ward's Colonial Village Flowers at 1515 Weaver Street in Scarsdale. Call 723-2888. That's 723-2-3-8.
Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather is brought to you on WVOX Worldwide by Entergy and the Indian Point Energy Center, right for New York.
Forecast Westchester County in the vicinity for this afternoon, mostly cloudy. Could see some light snow or rain showers. Highs will climb into the upper 30s. Becoming mostly clear through the overnight tonight. Lows dropping close to 20. Sunny skies early Thursday. Increasing clouds in the afternoon. Highs up near 30. Snow will develop overnight Thursday into Friday. Lows dropping lower 20s by daybreak Friday. Highs climbing into the lower 30s. Snow ends Friday afternoon. And partly sunny. Very cold for the weekend. Steve Pelletieri, Jr. reporting for WVOX Worldwide and WVIP.
At Entergy, meeting our region's need for reliable, affordable, and clean electricity is an everyday success story. That's because our Indian Point Energy Center supplies up to 38% of the region's power needs. It also produces some of the least expensive power generated in the region. And most importantly, it does not produce greenhouse gas emissions. That's right, zero greenhouse gases. This plays a key role in helping this area improve its air quality. So it should come as no surprise that a growing number of environmentalists, including Dr. Patrick Moore, the co-founder of Greenpeace, say nuclear power is a vital tool in the fight against global warming. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.safesecurevital.com. Because the more you know, the more you realize that Indian Point's clean, reliable, and affordable energy is a big part of the climate change solution.
There's always something happening right here on 1460 AM and worldwide at WVOX.com.
Just in touch with what's going on today.
Where many different voices are heard in the land.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates and my guest, the charming and well-informed Miss Hazel Rowley, who is the author of Franklin and Eleanor, a wonderful personal biography of their lives. She doesn't miss a trick. She covers all the if, ands, and buts and dots all the I's and crosses the T's, and of course I recommend it. Before our break, I asked her the following question. Tell us a bit about FDR's long period of recovery and the role of Missy LaHand in his recovery.
Well, they themselves called it later his wilderness years, because for 7 years he was more or less out of the public political scene and trying to find himself again. It was terribly, terribly hard. He wanted to walk again and he never could. He had a young secretary called Marguerite LaHand. The Roosevelt children called her Missy and the name stuck. She was a Boston girl from an Irish Catholic family. And sunny personality, cheerful, patient, and there's no doubt that she was deeply in love with Franklin. 18 months after Franklin came down with polio, during which time he was confined to the house in New York and to Hyde Park, going kind of mad with the family tensions, he went south with Missy and his black valet and some friends came and went, and they spent 6 weeks on a houseboat. Later on, he discovered Warm Springs, Georgia, where he loved to swim. And where
he had been there, actually, in 1905.
Oh, really?
Yeah, right.
Well, from 1924 onwards, he went there frequently with Missy. And from 1924 to 1928, he spent far more time in the South with Missy than at home with the family. Eleanor had the generosity to understand. She understood that Franklin needed to find himself again, find his feet, so to speak. And if his adoring secretary could help him feel like a man again, Eleanor wasn't going to complain. Franklin was very good, by the way. You know, their marriage now sort of opened up into a kind of community. And what he was very good at and would show himself to be very good at later as president was giving people the opportunity to do what they did best. Missy was terrific at being down in the South with him, helping him paste stamps into his stamp albums, sitting next to, you know, sitting at a fishing rod, putting up with the mosquitoes. That was not Eleanor's forte. She was much happier back in New York with the children, but most particularly plunged in politics with Louis Howe.
Right. And of course, she didn't like the Jim Crow aspects of the South.
No, not
she only visited a handful of times. And in a sense, FDR was very tolerant of her friends.
Yes.
You know, her work at the Val Kill, the furniture factory, her teaching at Todd Hunter, Nancy Cook, Miriam Dickerman. Many of these women today would be known to have other social proclivities, as we say.
And well, we should tolerant. Just very quickly mention that Franklin was very tolerant. And while he was setting up an extraordinarily bold community at Warm Springs for other polio patients. I mean, when he liked it, the first thing Franklin thought of was helping others. He also suggested to Eleanor that she build a cottage, which you can now visit, called Val Kill, with two friends who happened to be a lesbian couple. And he was he designed it, actually. It's a very beautiful little cottage. And she was to live there instead of with Franklin's mother while he was in the South. And this became also a very progressive community of democratic women. You know, this was the roaring 20s now. Knickerbockers, cigarette holders, women wore bobbed hairs.
Well, and you know, it's interesting in that aspect because he gravitates to her friends. As he says at Warm Springs, he is more like the polios, as they call them, than the others. And this is the wreckage of human life that flocked to Warm Springs. And literally, the people who ran Warm Springs were aghast at these people coming, and then he buys it and invests 2/3 of his own fortune in it, which his family thinks he's crazy doing.
Yes, but it was an act of remarkable generosity to help other polios find rehabilitation in an atmosphere that was really cheerful and encouraging.
And he became one of the first hydrotherapists.
Yes.
They used to call him Dr. Roosevelt in a sense, you know. You know, Louis Howe is a marvelous character in your book. Yeah, could you tell us more about his role in the Roosevelt marriage and part of this sad, tormented life he had with his own family, Louis Howe?
Well, as I said, he had moved in with the Roosevelts, and he only saw his own wife and two children at weekends. His wife, Grace, was very jealous of Eleanor. She accused him of having an affair with Eleanor, which I think is ridiculous. Eleanor loved Louis Howe. He loved her. Franklin loved Louis Howe. The thing is that he was an asthmatic. He coughed all day long and wheezed all night long. Franklin's mother, Sarah, detested him. She called him that dirty little man. But he was an incredible tower of strength in that household.
Well, he also was able to encourage Eleanor to be herself and to move beyond that, which is what women needed to be encouraged. They needed to have someone tell them that they could do it.
Yes, and this was the 20s. Women now had the vote, and women were an important force in the Democratic Party, Eleanor particularly.
No question. And in a sense, in this period of the wilderness, of course, he comes out for a short period of time. He makes his Happy Warrior speech nominating Al Smith in 24. He does it again in 1928. The irony is, who is really the Happy Warrior? Is it Smith or Roosevelt?
Yes. He meant it of Al Smith, but in fact he came over in the press as being the happy warrior in his two appearances in front of the Democratic National Convention, as you say, in 1924 and 1928. 1924 on crutches, 1928 he wanted to be seen as back on his feet, so he faked being able to walk with a cane and a strong son on his arm. And
his sons were big and strong.
Yes, and they had bruised arms after having, walking with their father. It was a difficult walk, very dangerous, but he faked the fact that he could stand and walk. He wanted to be seen as on his feet again.
And Eleanor's efforts in New York State with people like Caroline O'Day and people from the New York City labor movements and Rose Schneiderman. This is something that was unique to politics in America.
Yes.
This is something that had never existed before. Yes, there was a woman's suffrage movement and saloon league and things like that. But women never were out in the hustings.
These were marvelous women, these friends of Eleanor. And she was a leading figure. She really became, in the 1920s, while Franklin was in the wilderness, the leading woman in the women's section of the Democratic Party. So she was fundamental to attracting the women's vote to the Democratic Party.
And she was more important than Franklin Roosevelt.
At that time, in
that period of time. Now, of course, it was Howe's methodology, his idea that Eleanor would keep his name active. And of course, T.R. had died in 1919. T.R.'s sons were not able to carry his mantle. FDR was the emotional heir to the T.R. progressive legacy. And in a sense, Howe had that sense of politics. He probably was unique as a presidential advisor.
Well, you know, like FDR, Louis Howe had the good sense to recognize Eleanor's capacity, and they both gave her the rein to do what she proved to do incredibly well. Later on, after Louis Howe died, Franklin's press secretary, Stephen Early, really wanted to shut Eleanor up. You know, right. She had a daily press conference. She had her My Day column, which was syndicated throughout even the Republican papers. Stephen Early, who was a Southerner, therefore rather on the racist side, really wanted to shut the First Lady up. But yeah. Franklin, I think, was extraordinarily generous. It's what I keep stressing in my book, for giving Eleanor the rein.
And of course, he said, when asked about Eleanor, I don't tell my missus what to do or
That's
say.
Right.
And, you know, we have to go have a break for a commercial. I want to remind our audience that you're listening to WVOX 1460 AM. We are listening live streaming on WVOX. My guest, Hazel Rowley. We're talking about the remarkable and extraordinary marriage of two of the seminal figures of the 20th century, and indeed our whole history, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. We'll be back in a minute or two in our final segment. Thanks.
National news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Don Matheson. A Philadelphia abortion doctor is being charged with 8 counts of murder. The district attorney says Dr. Kermit Gosnell
forced the live birth of viable babies in the 6th, 7th, and 8th month of pregnancy, and then killed those babies.
DA Seth Williams. High-level meetings underway at the White House between American and Chinese leaders.
China's success has brought with it economic benefits for our people as well as yours.
President Obama. Speaking through an interpreter, President Hu Jintao sounded a positive tone.
The people of both China and the United States want to see further progress in our relations.
China agreeing to buy $45 billion in U.S. exports. December housing starts fell 4.3%, and the Commerce Department reports 2010 saw the second fewest number of housing starts in a half century. Fox News, we report, you decide.
We could be trendy and charge you to listen, but we'd rather keep things fair and simple.
Easy to work, up antenna, switch on.
We're proud to be free radio. WVOX Worldwide.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates with my guests, author, biographer, historian, Ms. Hazel Rowley, the author of Franklin and Eleanor, An Extraordinary Marriage. We all know that. We've been talking about her remarkable assessment of the legendary and unprecedented marriage of these two seminal figures of the 20th century, and regarding his, of course, remarkable rise to the presidency. It is truly extraordinary that FDR came down in polio in 1921, became a paraplegic, was eventually elected governor of New York in 1928, and eventually president. Tell us more about Eleanor's role in this process.
Well, as I said, Eleanor attracted the Democratic women's vote, which was important. She was a great supporter of Franklin. She was the one who said to him, "I'm telling everybody you're going to Houston without crutches, so make sure you keep at it," you know, practicing right. his walk. And her friends, she was seminal. And then, of course, he became governor of New York in 1928, served 2 terms. And as governor's wife, she played a phenomenal role. Mm. She decided to be hostess of the executive mansion for 4 days a week in Albany, and then 3 days a week she'd be in New York, continuing with her teaching and her political activity, a little bit more behind the scenes. And She was phenomenal as governor's wife. And the New Yorker, a journalist in the New Yorker said that there is no woman in the state who knows more about the political scene than Eleanor Roosevelt.
Mm. You know, she had many self-doubts. People don't realize that, but many who have read it. Periods of depression and ambivalence regarding the life of a political leader. How difficult was life in the governor's mansion for the Roosevelts, especially dealing with the gossip about Missy Lehan and her own bodyguard, Earl Miller?
Well, I think that those governor years, those 4 years in Albany, were very happy years for the Roosevelts. It's true that there was a lot of talk about the goings-on in the governor's mansion. Missy LaHand, FDR's secretary, had a room just down the corridor from FDR, and she spent far more time alone with him than Eleanor did. And when Eleanor was in New York for 3 days a week, it was Missy who was hostess at FDR's dinners. And then she refused to have a chauffeur. She said she wanted to drive herself. So Franklin said, "You've got to have a bodyguard." He assigned to her the dashing state trooper Earl Miller. And Earl Miller went around with Eleanor those years alone, driving alone in a car, talking for hours, and being, in fact, Franklin's eyes and legs, as they called it, going on inspection tours. Earl Miller was a wonderful friend, there's no doubt. He was devoted to the lady, as he called her, and he was the one who taught her that she looked terrific when she smiled in front of the camera. She was so conscious about her mouth and her jaw. He told her she looked, and she did. She had a beautiful smile. So I think they were very good years. Eleanor felt that she was doing a job well, and she was.
Mm. You know, President Roosevelt was a man who was confined to a wheelchair. On the other hand, Eleanor Roosevelt seemed to be everywhere at once. You can read the old Esquire cartoons, you know, about her being in a mine. You know, there's Eleanor giving an aura of movement and mobility to the White House. This was certainly to help the president privately and politically. How did women see Eleanor Roosevelt's independence?
Well, I'm sure she was at that time and ever since a tower of inspiration and strength.
Mm. So in other words, even today, people obviously compare an activist first lady,
yes,
to the actions of Eleanor Roosevelt. And of course, you know, Franklin Roosevelt, for all the people who do not know, had 999 press conferences. But those press conferences did not have women. Women weren't allowed. It was in the Oval Office. They gathered around his desk. She started press conferences for women reporters.
That's right, a weekly press conference, and insisted that men couldn't come. She was wanting to give women a chance to. It was very hard for women journalists, and she was always helping people, you know, give them opportunities.
And even in the Gridiron Dinner, which was basically for men and the press, didn't she have her counter dinner?
Yes, that was the annual press dinner at which the president used to speak. But women weren't allowed, not even wives. And so, yes, she did a counter dinner, gridiron for women.
You know, it's interesting. They spent a great deal of time apart. Most people see this as a sign of flawed marriage. You see it as a sign of their generosity, their devotion to each other, and to their political aims. Why? Why do you see it that way?
Well, I hope I don't idealize the marriage. Nobody has accused me of that. I show its problems. But the fact is, I see it, as I say, in a much more positive light than most. So Franklin was something of a flirt. He liked to be adored. But this is hardly surprising for a man with his golden childhood, who was doted on by his mother, an incredibly physical man who had to find his sense of manhood again after being crippled. Eleanor was earnest and insecure, with a voracious need to be loved. This is hardly surprising for a woman with her tragic childhood, who sensed that her mother never loved her and whose parents were both dead before Eleanor was 10. Even as First Lady, Eleanor always felt like the ugly duckling who had to deserve to be loved. Mm. So when it came to relaxation, they preferred to be with others. I don't find that particularly surprising. What they had as a glue in their marriage was an absolute passion for politics, politics as public service.
You know, there's a wonderful picture of them that won the Washington Press Corps photo contest, I believe, of 1941, and it's entitled, they're riding in a car, and he's waving, and he has his top hat, and it says, "Mr. and Mrs. America."
Yes.
And you know, in a sense that he loved the smell of the grease paint and the roar of the crowd. And in a sense, she didn't. She was reluctant to that, almost dragged into it. Very different kind of personalities. You have said that Eleanor Roosevelt could not have been Eleanor Roosevelt without FDR. You also say that FDR could not have been the man he was without Eleanor. Tell us more about that.
Well, first of all, during the Depression, they were both very active in the New Deal. And then came the war. And Eleanor was at her best when FDR sent her abroad as a goodwill ambassador to war-torn England in 1942, to the South Pacific in 1943. I can tell you, as an Australian, they just loved her. She turned up in her Red Cross uniform and and went through mile after mile of hospital wards bending over horribly wounded soldiers. They were viewed, this couple, throughout the world as embodying the best of the American character. And there's no doubt to me that FDR knew what he owed to Eleanor. She was far more than the woman behind the scenes. She was the woman on the scene. As you say, the press joked that she was everywhere, down a mine. Oh, my God, say the miners, here comes Mrs. Roosevelt.
Right.
But, you know, they together made possible what to most people would have seemed impossible. Eleanor Roosevelt once said, "You must do the things you think you cannot do." He did. She did.
Right.
As a couple, they both did.
You know, it's so interesting because they say of Franklin Roosevelt that he wore the cloak of office well, and that, as William Lichtenberg has written in The Shadow of FDR, that all the presidents after him have modeled themselves positively or negatively. In other words, what did he do? We'll do the opposite, you know, in that sense, including Nixon and Reagan. And Reagan had voted for FDR four times, mind you. The interesting thing is that Eleanor Roosevelt sets a model for first ladies. That's very, very hard. It's hard to fill those, 12-league boots, you know. It's hard to fill that, isn't that so?
She really did chisel out a role for herself at a time when America needed a first lady who would speak out. She was really quite remarkable.
And you know, summing up just as a reminder, when Eleanor Roosevelt asked to go to the South Pacific, all the brass were against it. They didn't want it. They thought it was political. They didn't want any piece of it. And finally, the commander-in-chief, the president, her husband, says, you know, you're going, and they'll let you go. And later on, she is thought of as the most important visitor, including all the Bob Hope and USO tours. And a remarkable thing happens. She writes, she has her secretary, Malvina Thompson, with her. She writes 25,000 letters to the wounded.
To the mothers, families of
families,
the wounded.
So that's right.
It's extraordinary. The girlfriends, the mothers, heard from Eleanor Roosevelt. She was unceasing in her work.
And those letters today are cherished.
Yes.
This is like a piece of history. You know, we're running down on time in our concluding moments or so. Could you sum up this remarkable partnership in its unique historical sense?
Sum it up.
That's not
well,
easy.
I just think that, as I've said, neither of them could have been what they were without each other. It's all very well talking about Lucy Mercer being so important to Franklin. I don't think she was.
Yeah.
The fact is, Franklin would not have had four terms. Remember that this remarkable couple was in the White House for 12 years, unprecedented and never to be repeated. And he would not have been, I think, without Eleanor at his side. On their campaign trails, when Eleanor did not appear on the back platform at the whistle stops with him, the crowds called for her.
Right.
They loved her.
Where is Eleanor?
Yes.
Yeah, and in a sense, you know, as we said, and I've said before, she thought the story was over when he died. She said that. I remember she said to Truman, you know, now you're the one in trouble. You know, the burden is on. But she did live a remarkable life. And another thing that I see as a student of FDR, I see that many people after their time who were close to them never had the careers. They either were worn out by their activity, worn out by their commitment, and never really shined after. Almost very few examples of the great people he had, you know? And that's sort of interesting.
I talk in the last chapter just briefly about what happened after FDR dies, what happens to Eleanor, and she definitely carried on with his legacy with incredible courage. She was both the widow of FDR, which gave her tremendous kudos, but also Eleanor Roosevelt in her own right, continuing work in the United Nations, which had always been Franklin's dream, and continuing with her public service during a period in American history, which was the Cold War, very conservative. Eleanor Roosevelt's My Day columns, which she continued, were a source of hope.
And of course, she was voted the most popular woman in the United States from 1946 to 61, basically a year before her death in 1962. I think most of the country still misses both of them. And
that's, were they only right, here now?
Right. I want to thank, of course, we've run out of time, my distinguished and charming guest, Ms. Hazel Rowley, for joining me today and gracing the studios of WVOX on The Advocates. Next week, I'll be hosting Mary Jo Waitley and Gina DiCrescenzo, lawyers affiliated with the Children's Advocacy Unit of the Legal Services of the Lower Hudson Valley. My guest host will be the lawyer Guy Fairstein. We'll discuss defending the legal rights of children. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocates broadcasts, you can access them on my website, advocates-wvox.com. where all the information my guests are posted. Thank you, Hazel, again for joining me.
Thank you so much, Richard. It was a great pleasure.
Thanks.